such a beautiful day. Amazing. I walked all around the neighborhood, peeking in everybody's gardens to see what's going on there. There's a lot going on. Whoa. And at the same time, all the coming is happening. There's the going also. And Donna Lynn brought news of Joyce, who's in the hospital and not doing well at all. So as the coming into form, the going away from form is also happening. It's what makes spring so poignant. The flowers bloom, but also the flowers are falling at the same time. Showers and showers of them. So someone sent me a talk that Gil gave as part of the Sutra study group that's going on. Apparently 80 people are attending day-long lectures, then with lots and lots of in-between study. There's tremendous interest in studying the sutras. I'm not sure I'm getting this right, but I'm getting it as right as it means to me. So don't hold me to the absolute fact of it, because I may not be completely correct. But the main thing is that Gil noticed that Buddha actually took responsibility for raising his own child in Buddhism, in the teaching. And that there are three places in the sutras where he takes Rahula aside and instructs him. And Gil took this from the point of view of a dad with young kids, young boys. And he thought how great this was, that you could actually take your child aside and start to help him understand this practice. Very touching. But as I read it, I thought about it for all of us, for myself as Buddha's child, and how, although we grow up in this practice, presumably, that the truth of it is that we recycle through the whole process over and over again. And it never gets old. It's always new. We always think we're heading toward enlightenment, and apparently in this story, Rahula, at the end, is very close to enlightenment, Gil says. But that's just one enlightenment. One of many. The story begins when Rahula is seven and tells a lie. And at that age, there are lots of lies. It's just, it's inevitable. And Buddha takes him aside and says, you know, that was a lie. And if you do lying, you just get yourself in deeper and deeper trouble. You're creating suffering for yourself and for other people. And from that, he began to open up the precepts for him, not as saying you were naughty, not as saying you were bad, but saying, look at what happens when you do this. Look what it's like for you. How do you feel? And how does it make other people feel? And make this your study. So he encouraged him all through those early years of his childhood to just keep studying how it was for him to pass through life in terms of the precepts. What is it like to take something that you weren't given? To say something that you know was not true? We never get over it. I was with longtime practicers not long ago, and they all began to gossip. I couldn't believe it. And I was doing it too. All of a sudden I thought, my word, what are we doing? This is ridiculous. And saw again, you know, two more people. Hi, Ritu. We started a little early, and you're exactly on time.
Thank you.
I'm so sorry.
That's exactly what I need to hear.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
This is my friend, Samuel. I have to come here to talk, if that's okay.
Yes. Well, I just started, so I can start all over again. Let's do introductions, though, first.
Julie,
Wendy,
Connor,
Samuel,
Chris,
Angie. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I was talking about a story that Gil told about Buddha's child's education in the teaching. That Gil went through the sutras and found stories of Rahula, Buddha's son. When Buddha went back, after he'd abandoned his family, he went back, and by that time his son was 6 or 7 years old, I think. And the child's mother was very angry and wouldn't even talk to Buddha, of course. But the child came to him, and eventually in their relationship while Buddha was there, the child lied. He lied about something, a simple childish lie. And Buddha called him on it, and he said, you know how it feels when you do that, and you might think about how it makes other people feel. And make a study of how you are in context with telling the truth or bending it. Why you do that, what it means to your sense of yourself. So already at a very young age, he had this little boy just paying attention to himself as he was relating to everyone in his world. And in terms of all of the precepts, how it was when he squashed an ant, how it was when he took something that wasn't given to him, how it was that he was angry, hateful. All those things that, of course, it's like weather. It's all passing through us all the time. And if we don't notice it, we're just on automatic all the time. So already, as a young age, he was waking his little boy up. And what I said was that this process is never ending, that we keep on passing through this cycle of waking and sleeping, you could say, and that at least in my life, it certainly feels that way, that there's no end point to it at all. So when the boy was in his teens, Buddha took him aside again and began to teach him mindfulness. He taught him about the five skandhas. He explained how all things are an accumulation, including the human being, that we're first of all this body, this piece of meat, you could say. This enormously complex functioning of bones and blood, first of all, and everything that goes into just keeping the whole machine going, but then beyond that, how we take things in, and having taken things in, how we invent stories and create a self for ourselves, based on what comes in and how we factor it, how we make it up. So if we're in a good mood, everything that comes to us is good. If we're in a bad mood, it's all terrible, terrible, terrible. It's hard to see until you stop and really study it, really understand that these things aren't fixed, that they're not permanent. And in fact, that we can even do something about a bad mood. We can do something about a misapprehension. We can reinvent ourselves over and over. And to understand how we're doing that, that we're doing it, is powerful, powerful knowledge. And the beginning of a mindful life in the world. So that when we take things in, we're completely present to the world as we are in the moment. That's our information. And from there, of course, we cook up all kinds of ideas. And many ideas just pass through us from who knows where. But to come back over and over to the original impulse, the original experience brings us continually back into the world as it is, so that we're not so constantly misled as we stumble through life. You could sit in a chair too.
No, this is fine. Sit.
You sure?
Yeah. It's
not easy,
I
know. Yeah.
This is good for me.
So that was Rahula's teenage years. His study not only of his sort of virtue, you could say, his life in terms of relationship with others and staying authentic and staying honest, but also being awake to what actually he was making of what he perceived of the world. Very interesting for us always. When I was at Plum Village with Thich Nhat Hanh, he took us for a walk every single morning, even though it was below freezing. In fact, it was almost zero. It was so cold. There was frost on the windows and on the trees. Not ice, just frost. And we would go out all bundled up and walking with his meditation walk, mindfully walking, beautifully walking through the frosty world of southern France. And he would stop every 10 steps or so and just breathe and look and smile. And it was so wonderful. He was just really liking where he was. It wasn't just demanding that he go and look and be, you know, this is my job now, I'm being mindful. He was just completely enjoying the whole thing. That's the first time I understood what mindfulness really meant. That it isn't something grim and important even. It's just, what a wonderful way to be. That we have it in us to be our world, like a tree is, or a bird. We can just enjoy this. And even when things get really difficult, as long as we're not caught by the how can this happen to me mode, we can still, if not enjoy it, meet it clearly without too much angst. But there was a third lesson that Buddha gave to his boy when the boy turned 20, reached his majority, and Buddha started teaching him emptiness. Had him begin to ask himself where his self was. Who is this Rahula? How is this Rahula? Can you find him somewhere? Is he in the body? Is he the same as the body when he was a little boy? Is he the same as the body is going to be when he's 80 years old? Are his thoughts Rahula? But they don't stay put. They're not the same. Moment by moment, they keep changing. Which thought is Rahula? Can you catch one and hold it and say, oh, this is me? So little by little, the long study of the self begins for Rahula, which is the study of emptiness, trying to find the place where something is fixed. In a way, it's a little bit like studying a chair. We know it's a chair. We have a name for it. It has a certain form. I'm learning German now. It's a Stuhl. It's, you know, it can be a lot of different noises that we make that we know that that's a chair, a Stuhl. And yet if you take a leg off, well, it's still a Stuhl. We still know it is, of course. If you take another leg off, we can still recognize it, but if you start taking it all to pieces, all it is a pile of lumber. It's just, you could turn it into firewood, then you could call it firewood. Or you could call it junk. It becomes something entirely different, because the forms are never fixed. And yet, that chair, in whatever form, is a piece of us. That all forms of life are connected. There is no way to disconnect form. We can hide it, we can bury it under the earth, we can put it in a cave, we can put it on top of Mount Everest. It'll still be connected to here, to us. Wherever we are, we're connected. It's a very consoling thought, because life often seems so lonely or so alone. Because of the way our minds work, and the way our culture works as well, we know so well our individuality. And it feels like separation. But to study emptiness means to study, though it seems paradoxical because the word emptiness is so vague, to study emptiness is to study connection, to study the seamless interconnection of all things. That's what emptiness is. So that the self and its stories become a part of something so very huge that we begin to see how we are, how it is. And we begin to take our seat in the midst of everything, with everyone. In the end, in Zen, we say, not one, not two. We can't really say, oh, I'm all one with everything, because here I am. But can't really say, it's just me, because here we all are. And I think that's why Tai was so smiling all the time as he walked through the frosty forest. It just feels so fine to be walking all by oneself with everyone. All the time. So I said at the beginning, I'm not sure this is what Gil was saying, but this is what I made out of Gil's story. So I'll have to apologize to him if I got it wrong. But I think that's pretty much what it was. Those three teachings that he gave to his little son, which I think apply to each one of us. And if we just went to school to those three teachings over and over, I think we'd be in pretty good shape. So that's the talk I brought. Brief as always, I'm afraid. Are there questions? Discussion? Donalyn?
Is that the only child of the historical Buddha?
Yes. Yes, he left when the child was born, or very soon after the child was born. His wife died. So I've always thought that had a great deal to do with his leaving, as well as his being inspired, especially by the sight of old age, sickness, and death, which was such a shock to him. But he experienced the death of his wife.
Before he left?
Yes. So he left the baby with his wife's sister, who was also his wife. Apparently he had a number of wives. So I can imagine that often happens when you experience death in such a close quarters. You have to go out and figure it out. It's a shock. But he came back. There was in the early times when I first started teaching, and when people started talking about Buddha's history and how he did things, how he left home and abandoned his family. The women in the group would just get furious, really angry. You know, how could he do that? And of course, he didn't abandon them to penury. It was a palace, so it was not that anybody was going to go hungry. Everything was very well taken care of until the war started, and then he went back when the war began and tried to stop it. So he was very much a presence always. And the other place where women got really, really mad was when he refused to let women become part of his group. He said no twice. And when he was finally persuaded, it was a very big deal. And there's still some women who are annoyed by that. How could he do that? How could he possibly do that? But in the context, it was incredible that he actually ever said yes. It's almost unbelievable. And there's a monastery in Japan of women who have an elaborate ceremony to celebrate not Buddha, but Ananda, his disciple, who persuaded Buddha to let the women in. Very cool.
What did she say that persuaded him?
He said, "You're teaching that all beings have Buddha nature. If all beings are Buddha nature, how about the women? Aren't they too?" And Buddha said, "Well, yeah." Just about like that. He said, "Yeah, yes, you're right. That's what I say, yes." And Ananda said, "Well." And he said, "Okay, all right. But we've got to protect the women," he said, "and we've got to make some extra rules for them so that they don't go out by themselves. They don't hang out with men. They don't, you know, there are a whole lot of rules and regs for the women that the men don't have, because there were a lot of dangers in those days and because they didn't trust women so much." But he did allow it. And his stepmother, his mother's sister, was the first one, Mahabhadrapati. She was the one who kept begging, "Please, please, let us come." And finally, they all shaved their heads and came to him the third time. Already, they were looking as if they were ordained. And that's when Ananda persuaded him. So she became a very, very fine, very famous teacher at IMC, the Gill's group in Redwood City. They have a beautiful statue of her teaching. Very beautiful. So she became and created an order of women who became very wonderful teachers. That was the beginning. Wendy?
So do we hear any more of Rahula after these stories? Is he a disciple?
He became a disciple. And I don't remember anything but the young stories, but there may be other ones. I'll look them up in the index. It'd be interesting to follow it out. Apparently, these were from the earliest sutras, so they're closer to being authentic than, you know, the sutras are a big collection of stories, some of which happened many, many, many hundreds of years after Buddha, and have different points of view. So to find the earliest ones is always considered to be closer to being authentic.
So, is this the Pali Canon?
Mm-hmm. I think the middle-length discourses is where these stories are from, which is a huge book, this thick.
I know in Pema Chodron's book she references a book, a sutra that Stephen Batchelor translated, the Sutra of the Three Heaps. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't.
Yes.
What are the three heaps?
I am very curious.
Oh, well, I'll find that out too.
Okay. This index, yes.
Remember one story where Buddha or Shariputta asked Rahula to be like a mentor to some of the younger monks?
Uh-huh.
I can't remember, which kind of makes sense too, that he.
Yes.
And it might have been after Buddha's death. I can't remember.
Hmm.
I do remember it because I just remember it. It's a cool concept.
Yeah. Well, we don't really study those sutras so much, or at least with Koban we didn't study those sutras. In the Vipassana tradition, it's done much more. And Zen kind of exploded them in a way, or created a whole another level of appreciation of Buddha's teaching. Not beyond the sutras, because they're all based on the sutras. The basic teaching is exactly that. But Mahayana Buddhism extrapolates from that greatly. And I found it, lately very interesting and helpful to go back to those original teachings and kind of explore. There's so much, and it's so hard to know if you're not a scholar which is which. Which is somebody's. How much of it is made up, and how much of it is made up in order to persuade someone of something. Then the various schools rise up, and then they're contesting with each other about what's really true and what Buddha really said, and then I get annoyed because it seems like such a waste of time. And Zen just cuts through all of that. And Buddha did too. He always said life is too short and our misunderstanding is too great to waste our time fighting over small things. But we love to do it. Time to sit? All right. Thank you.